Hello, and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, April 7th, 2023. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. What does it mean for a workplace to be truly inclusive for all workers? This week on Rabble Radio, labor reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga sits down with Jade Pichette from Pride at Work to discuss creating safe and inclusive workplaces for trans, non-binary, and agender people. Through education, community building, and dialogue, Pride at Work Canada works with workplaces across the country to celebrate and protect all employees, regardless of their gender expression, gender identity, and sexual orientation. To learn more about Pride at Work, please visit prideatwork.ca. Jade Pichette is an inclusion, diversity, equity, and accessibility professional based in Toronto, Ontario. Currently, Pichette serves as the Director of Programs at Pride at Work Canada. Pichette was one of the authors of Transitioning Employers, a series of policies and practices for trans-inclusive workplaces. Here are Pichette and Kaluge-Kasuga in conversation. Take a listen.
So thank you so much, Jade, for joining me on the radio show today.
Happy to be here.
Can you tell me a bit about Pride at Work Canada and what you do with the organization?
So Pride at Work Canada, we're a national member services nonprofit. So essentially, large employers pay an annual membership fee to be able to access our programs, which includes education, consulting, networking events, and more. We really are focused on making sure that all Canadians have access to equitable and meaningful and affirming employment, especially around gender identity, gender expression, and sexual orientation. And so I'm the Director of Programs at Pride at Work Canada. So within my role, I'm making sure that our content is relevant, is at the forefront of making sure that we're making inclusive workplaces.
And so since, you know, we're just a few days after Trans Day of Visibility, I was wondering what kind of work Pride at Work Canada has been doing this year to, you know, mark that day.
Yeah, so we've been doing programming throughout the year, really, where we make sure to bring in trans, non-binary, and agender educators and workers to really discuss their experiences. And we try to do that all year round. So I know for a lot of folks that the Trans Day of Visibility is kind of one of the main observances, but for us, it's a ongoing piece. And so around this time, we tend to do more, you know, talking to the media, such as yourself, and trying to do that public advocacy around the Trans Day of Visibility, as well as working directly with our partners to make sure that their workplaces are discussing these issues.
So what are some of the main messages? You know, you've talked about this public aspect that you guys do, especially around Trans Day of Visibility. What are some of the big messages you want to get out there around this time?
Well, it's very important to know that trans and non-binary folks are some of the most educated group of people in Canada, and yet we have some of the worst employment outcomes. And so we tend to see that trans people in Canada are 5 times more likely to be below the low income cutoff, also known as the poverty line, within Canada. And we really see that there's significant barriers to leadership, to advancement, to retention for trans and non-binary communities. And this is something that happens in every industry. And so really our main message is that we want to make sure that these workplaces are inclusive, and that takes work. You know, that takes real policy changes, that takes making your different anti-harassment policies be inclusive, you're having a trans-inclusive policy being inclusive. parental and bereavement leave, as well as things like benefits, policies, and practices. So we really try to talk about the gamut of work that needs to be done and move away from the idea of if we just hear one trans person speak, that's going to make all the difference, right? We have to make concrete, actual change.
And can you tell me some of the specifics about the types of concrete change that are needed that some people may not even realize are needed?
Yeah, so one of the pieces is obviously around benefits, where there's been more and more discussion about gender-inclusive healthcare, both within the workplace and outside of the workplace. And increasingly, more and more insurance companies are actually covering gender-inclusive care as part of their benefits plan. And so that's one thing that we've really seen to be a big push around right now is creating these inclusive benefits. And so that provides access to trans people with employment, obviously, but to some gender-affirming care procedures and also medications that they might not have access to otherwise, which is an equity issue in terms of benefit access. But we look at other benefits, as I mentioned, parental leave. So making sure that pregnancy and parental leave policies are based around that and that they're gender neutral. Within bereavement leave, we want to make sure that if somebody is losing somebody in their life, that they're able to make the choice about who is important to them, not based on who is like legally related to them. Because we know that legal relation doesn't necessarily translate, especially for trans communities, but not only trans communities, to who is important in their lives. But it's also simple things like hiring practices and making sure that trans people are being considered for work to begin with. We often see that when trans people get to the hiring table, people don't understand even the simplest of things like their name and pronoun and how to use that properly, let alone more complicated things like how to describe whether they have an inclusive workplace or what their culture is like, and whether that trans person is going to feel safe at work. And often they're told that they're not the right fit, that they're an unusual hire, and really kind of get stuck even at the recruitment phase. So we kind of look at it from these multiple angles of the folks who are already in workplaces, some of which aren't out but are working and are active, as well as the people who are looking to get work, who have been denied work consistently.
I'm curious about, you mentioned effects for people who are not out as well. And so I'm wondering, what are kind of the conditions, the workplace conditions that could cause harm for people who are not out?
So people who are not out, and this can be for many different reasons. This might be that they haven't felt safe to transition at all. It might mean that they have transitioned and are just not disclosing that to their colleagues. And some of the things that those folks tend to go through is increased isolation, feelings of disconnection, feelings of not being a part of. Also, we look at retention rates. So people who are not out are less likely to stay in their jobs. And that's because they don't feel safe in the culture, right? And so that can mean overhearing transphobic and other bigoted remarks, because there's an assumption that there's nobody in the room who shares that identity. And it's really when people think there's no one in the room that they say the nastiest things. And so for folks who aren't out, they're less likely to stay long-term in their jobs. They're less likely to advance in their positions because they're maybe not as comfortable networking and making new connections within their workplace. And we really see this kind of detrimental impact to their entire career. Not to say that people who are out don't have detrimental impacts, because they do, but those detrimental impacts can be different.
So then the other side of that, what are some of the detrimental impacts for people who are out?
Well, obviously, we are at a place where trans people are increasingly becoming the scapegoat. We are the scapegoat for many different things. We're being called everything under the sun, including groomers, including being some type of pedophile in some way, not to mention just kind of the old slurs that I won't repeat here. And so it can be the direct violence, whether that's physical or verbal or sexual, that trans people can experience at work. They can get asked questions about their genitalia, about their sex lives, all of these things that are quite awful and you wouldn't do for a non-trans coworker, or you shouldn't do at least. And we can also see suddenly issues arising. So quite often we see people who've come out who had never had any performance issues on their record, who suddenly are being told by their manager that there's performance issues that weren't there before. And so if they weren't there before, there's probably a reason they weren't there before. And there's probably a reason why there's suddenly issues with this employee. And so it can be covert as well, with being told that you're not allowed to use a certain bathroom, or that there's been complaints against you. And usually these are just coming from people who are discriminatory against the community. And so that's certainly not every trans person in the workplace's experience, but these are things that have more than been provided and told to me on a number of occasions by many different trans folks.
And so, like, how do we create a workplace that provides psychological safety for trans people who have every right to work with dignity and in safety?
Well, we look at those systemic changes and institutional changes. You know, we really need to make those changes when it comes to policy, when it comes to our practices, when it comes to our facilities, and reduce essentially some of the places of potential conflict as well within that. So if you're forcing everybody to use only gendered bathrooms, that can become a site of conflict. Well, as if you provide the option of people being able to use whatever space feels comfortable and safe to them, you know, if we all have a gender neutral bathroom at home, so I don't understand why we can't have it at work too, right? And beyond that, it's, you know, really making some of that cultural change. And this isn't to say that we should immediately train everyone, because I think training needs to be very intentional, and it can sometimes lead to backlash if it's just rolled out without policies and procedures in place. And, you know, we really need to create some of those spaces for trans people to also just feel safe in general. So that can be employee resource groups, for example. So, you know, a 2S LGBTQIA plus employee resource group, or even a trans-specific employee resource group, can really be a powerful space for also creating that sense of community and connection that people really need. So, you know, at the end of the day, if people aren't feeling that community and connection with their colleagues or with other trans folks, that's when issues can really arise. Because when you have support, when you have community, you know, some of those small things can roll off your back a little easier, especially if your organization is making some of those bigger changes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. And I think, yeah, community and collective power is a common theme in all labor organizing. Creating better working conditions is that together we are stronger. And so I kind of want to shift slightly in this interview, because I am catching you in Calgary right now. That's where you're calling in from. And you're going to be doing a panel on uncovering at work. And so I guess in order to create these spaces where there are these networks of other queer trans workers, people need to be willing to enter into these spaces. And so how do we make it so the workplace is able to have these spaces exist within them without, you know, destroying kind of the sense of safety of those networks?
Well, there's a lot of organizations who are actively making these changes and actively care about 2S LGBTQIA plus inclusion. I mean, we have over 250 partners for a reason, because each of those companies is really trying to make that inclusive culture. And so often that does include events of ours, of other organizations like the CGLCC, Start Proud, and others who have a workplace focus, and really try and make space for those networking opportunities, for those mentorship opportunities, those connection opportunities. And those have a really powerful impact. So, you know, being able to enter a space and, you know, as you kind of like alluded to in your intro about people feeling comfortable entering a space, some people who come to our events aren't out, you know, and they might not be out to their supervisor. They might not be out to their coworkers. They might not be out at home and yet still feel safe enough to come to one of our events. So I think that says something special about the spaces that we create, is really like providing that sense of safety. And workplaces can have those networking events internally as well. They can have those mentorship opportunities where you don't necessarily have to go through your supervisor to get access to them. Because really, I sometimes like to say that middle management is where DEI goes to die. Because quite often we get stuck with whoever our immediate supervisor is. And some of those folks can be really, really supportive and can launch your career, and then some are less so. And so being able to enter into spaces and connect with people, regardless of your supervisor, is an important thing. And so that's one of the reasons why we create these spaces.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I guess, yeah, so I'm wondering a bit then, can you name some of the spaces or programs that Pride at Work Canada has created with your partners, your over 250 partners?
So we have our Pro Pride series. So we do a series of educational and networking events across the country called Pro Pride. This year, we're planning them in quite a few cities, over a dozen cities. In the coming year, I should say. And really, those are networking events that are in person. Usually there's some form of educational content. So speakers from the community who are talking about the workplace. But we also have our events such as Rendezvous and Matrices. So Rendezvous is for women and non-binary people, and Matrices is for trans, non-binary, and agender folks. And both of those were created very intentionally because we knew that traditional networking spaces were not safe for a lot of people. They're also virtual, which gives access to people who may not be in a major city and may not have the ability to travel to a major city for a one-off event, right? And so all of those spaces are ones that we really try to build a sense of belonging for people and show them that there is a community that they can be a part of, that they can connect to, and that there are other people out there who are doing similar work to them, just in different organizations, sometimes different industries, that they can connect with.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That sounds really, really awesome that these spaces exist. I was a little curious, just before this interview, you had mentioned to me that you've been out for 20 years. And so I'm wondering, you know, based on your experience as an openly trans person, what have these spaces done to change the experience for people who are trans and facing these difficulties in the workplace?
A lot of these spaces didn't exist until more recently. So, you know, 20 years ago, there was no Pride at Work Canada. There was no, there was very little work when it came to workplace inclusion, even on sexual orientation. And so there's been a major shift in that time where we do see the existence of spaces. We see more intentional networks. We see the entire conversation having shifted because, 20 years ago, we didn't even have legal protections of gender identity and gender expression in the workplace. So we had them in the Northwest Territories, but that was it. And some of the case law around that still needed to be built at the time. So in Ontario, we only saw that in 2012 with Toby's Law. And then federally, we saw that in 2018 with the bill that went through the Senate and received royal assent on gender identity and gender expression. And so you know, the legal protections weren't even there. And so it's really within the last 5 years or so that I've seen a real shift in and intentional creation of trans-centric spaces around employment. So there were certainly spaces around social connection, there were places around healthcare, but there was less around the workplace specifically. And now it's becoming a more important topic. There's more research on the topic by organizations like the Trans Pulse Project, Justice Trans, and then ourselves. And we really are seeing, you know, a unbelievable shift in terms of the amount of people who feel safe to come out. And that is an amazing thing, in my opinion. It's something that sometimes brings a little bit of a tear to my eye just to see how many people feel safer to make that decision to come out and to be out and to transition in whatever way that means for them.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And that's kind of what I was getting at with my question is there's been some great strides. And I know even for myself, I'm a younger queer person, but seeing these changes over the past few years, like you said, brings a tear to the eye. So thank you so much for all the work you do. Is there anything else you wanted to add or mention just about, you know, anything Pride at Work Canada has going on or upcoming?
So we have our webinar series as well, which is coming up. But the major piece that I would plug is our upcoming research. So we are coming out with research next month called Lead with Pride, and it'll be looking at the barriers to leadership for 2S LGBTQIA plus communities and the importance of things like mentoring, for instance, to really shift that. And that's something that we saw consistently through our research was that mentorship was one of the most important things that our communities needed to be able to advance. And so if you're somebody who is listening to this and you have the ability to mentor somebody else, do it. If you want to find different ways, look into some of the different mentorship programs that are out there, whether that's through an employment service, whether that's through an organization like Jumpstart Refugee Talent or the Ensh Network, and find somebody to connect with and help them in their journey.
Perfect. Well, I look forward to reading more about that research. I think that's definitely something of an important piece to building collective power that I've noticed as well. So I'm excited to see kind of your findings. Thank you so much for chatting with me today, Jade.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Was Jade Pichette, Director of Programs at Pride at Work Canada, and Rabble Labour reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Gabby and Jade. If you'd like to learn more about the work Pride at Work Canada does, please visit prideatwork.ca. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It, and for that, we'll hand it over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in Canadian politics, Gordon Laxer argues that an inquiry into foreign meddling in Canadian politics must include foreign corporations, particularly those in the oil and gas sector. All major oil corporations operating in Alberta and Canada as a whole are majority foreign owned. Even if they are headquartered in Canada, many are backed by foreign money or influenced by foreign actors in other ways. The Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers employs 36 full-time lobbyists and spent nearly $1.5 million during the 2019 federal election on ads and donations to specific politicians. Such foreign influence and money in Canadian elections has a real influence on our domestic politics and should be taken as seriously as any alleged interference by a state actor like China. In environmental news, Rabble columnist Ole Henriksen explained that solving the climate crisis requires also solving the problem of ecological overshoot. Ecological overshoot is when resources from the environment are consumed faster than they can naturally be replenished. Canada is one of the world's worst contributors to ecological overshoot. Globally, it would take the resources of 1.8 Earths to support the world's current population. But if everyone in the world consumed resources at the same rate as the average Canadian, it would take 5 Earths. In fact, if the world consumed resources at the same rate as Canada, the world's resources would be depleted within 2 months. Renewable energy technology is only a band-aid solution to the problem of overconsumption. The real solution is to find ways to consume less and consume more efficiently. Hendrickson writes, quote, "We can't continue overconsuming resources, degrading ecosystems, and producing more waste than the Earth can absorb," end quote. Also this week, the Black Class Action Secretariat is calling on support from the labor movement to address federal discrimination. Labor reporter Gabriella Kaluga-Kasuga reports, the Treasury Board has ruled that the Canadian Human Rights Commission has been discriminating against its own black employees. The ruling comes as a blow to an organization supposedly dedicated to upholding the human rights of all Canadian citizens, and has increased pressure on them to reach a settlement with black workers in the federal government. Nicholas Marcus Thompson, executive director of the Black Class Action Secretariat, explained that systemic racism in the public service is deeply entrenched, and attempting to eliminate it has exposed black workers to even more harm. To minimize this harm and achieve the justice that black workers deserve, Thompson said the Black Class Action Secretariat needs all of Canada's labor movement to join them in upping the pressure. Finally, join us for Off the Hill this month. Foreign interference has made headlines in Canada lately. But what about corporate interference? Corporate interference, or corporate capture, refers to the means by which large corporations can, and do, influence politicians and political decision-making. You don't hear about it too much in mainstream media, but it's unfortunately alive and well in Canada. We have to wonder, how does corporate interference affect the climate crisis in Canada? This month, join our Off the Hill panel as we discuss this more. Guests this month include MP Leigh Gazan, Rabble columnist and policy researcher Chuka Ejekam, and climate and housing activist Diana Yoon, hosted by Robin Brown and Libby Davies. Save your spot for this free event today and join us this April 19th, 2023 at 7:30 p.m. Eastern, 4:30 p.m. Pacific. As always, you can find the full version of these stories and much, much more on rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Follow us on social media across channels at RabbleCA. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, a big thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.